The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
Earnings beats rally the markets. Trump's Fed pick is now leaning towards Powell. Contributor confidence, it's the highest since 2004. Listener questions and more, all this and much more on episode number 532 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome to the end of October 2017, just a couple of days ahead of Halloween, and there's a lot going on. Andrew Horowitz here, the host of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. And there's a lot that's been happening. You've been seeing the markets rallying on earnings. What is actually going on? I know there's a lot of emails I get from people that are pretty skeptical about the markets, looking at, it's an artificial bubble and this is not going to last and all that. I mean, even President Trump, before he took office, talked about this whole bubble-ish type of thing that was going on with the markets, and price was too high and earnings estimates were just all over the place. And, you know, we're seeing that this incredible amount of liquidity is just the only thing that's pushing things up. But the truth of the matter is that the story has changed a bit over the last several months. In particular, when we look at the economics that are setting up the backdrop of what's happening, as well as what's going on with earnings, well, we had kind of the perfect setup recently, right? We saw that earnings and economics basically inspired the rally that just won't quit. And there's a lot of other things too. Yes, we have a lot of liquidity and we have the potential for taxes. We have all this good stuff happening. But really, if you want to just break it down and spend a little time without anything else looking at, just check out the charts of the recent economic reports that were put out. Look at the earnings numbers that have been reported by some of the majors out there, in particular some of the ones last week that really look pretty darn good. Now, it was interesting to note that even with all that and backing it up before Friday of last week, pretty much the markets were just treading water. Things were looking good, but there's some concern about some of whether or not the budget would pass. Well, that happened. Okay, that's good news. And we saw that there was some concern and has been about who would be the next Fed chair appointment. Okay, so we have a little bit more resolution on that, which we'll talk about in a moment how this whole process is going. We had a lot of earnings put out and there was some good news out there, but the question then started to come in and creep in the conversation about, can this continue? Are we going to be able to see over the next few quarters these kind of numbers that we're seeing from many of these companies? And there was some skepticism. And then Thursday night, we saw numbers from companies like Amazon and Microsoft come out and Intel. Wow, pretty amazing. And we saw the NASDAQ just take off. I think the NASDAQ was up like 2.5% on Friday. Up until that point, the NASDAQ was down for the week. The Dow Jones, close to being down, swung to a new high by the end of the week, as did the S&P 500. S&P 500, if it wasn't for Friday, would have actually been down for the week. But you got to put all things into consideration when we talk about this. So it was a new record high for the NASDAQ and the S&P. Now, what I thought was really interesting and I wanted to look at was, okay, well, how is the total stock market doing from the perspective of a non-cap weighted perspective? Because we know that the S&P 500 is a market cap weighted index, meaning that the largest of large stocks have a disproportionate effect on the overall index performance. The larger the stock is, the more of a percentage that it has in terms of its weighting. So its market cap percentage is higher. Okay, so that's fine. That's how it's done. The Dow Jones is totally different. The Dow Jones is a price-weighted index. The higher the price of the actual stock, the higher amount it has in terms of a percentage magnitude of the overall performance. A bit of an antiquated style. The market cap is one that's been much more readily accepted because the larger stock should have a much more important placement overall in the performance and the underlying performance of the index. So that's what has happened. But there's also other indices to look at that you can see a little bit more clarity and get some more insight about what's going on overall. One of them is the S&P 500 equal weighted index, meaning that as opposed to the cap weighted index, where you have a capitalization of the stocks having the greatest weight, what this does, it takes the 500 stocks that are in the S&P 500, the 500 in total, and it says, okay, well, what is the average stock doing? It takes the total average of those. So it doesn't weight them according to anything more than just 1/500th of the performance per position. So it's an equal weighted index. And for the most part, that was down for the week. It narrowly went positive on Friday, but what is that telling us? Really, I mean, that's the question, right? What are we gleaning from that piece of information? That the S&P 500 itself was up, this was flat, it was down for the week about 1%. What that's telling us is that the largest of large stocks had a disproportionately heavy weight in the performance for the week to the upside. Again, so what is that saying? What that's saying is that the rally was not broad-based. Does that mean that's something terrible? Is that an omen? Is that something we need to be worried about? Not necessarily. It's just something to look at. What it says is that the smaller stocks held back the overall performance. The stocks that weren't the heaviest weights, the non-Apples, not Google, not Amazon, not Intel, not Microsoft. Those are all tech names, but the biggest of big names were the ones that really performed the best last week, where the bottom rung, if you will, because we look at the differential between the market cap weighted and the average weighted, equal weight, and one is outperforming. And by looking at that differential, it could tell us really what's happening there. Is this a broad-based rally, or are people looking to get primarily into the larger cap stocks for whatever the reason is? And if that is the case, let's take a look at further things like total market breadth, what's happening with the market itself, and be careful to understand that if we are looking at investing in an index, if you're just in the SPY or the Qs, that could benefit dramatically. But look at your other stocks that you may be holding outright to figure out, well, what's happening there? What's happening with my small caps? What's going on with the mid caps? What's happening with my foreign stocks? Is there a continuation of this rally overall, or do I need to be worried, concerned, or possibly readjusting my portfolio with the understanding that not everything is participating? So just something to look at. Take a look at that. You could probably find that. There's a couple of different ways to find. Just look up S&P Equal Weight Index. There's an ETF you can follow. There's the index you can follow. Yeah, just take a look at that. Now, one of the other things that really moved markets last week, from what I can tell at least, was this whole trial balloons, that I'll call them, that were being sent up left and right about who would be the next Fed chair. Now, let me explain how this works. So we saw that, well, there was a narrowing down of approximately five names that were now in the hat about a week and a half ago. That was one trial balloon. Okay, well, what are the names in there? How does the market react to those basic names that are in there? Market didn't flinch. There was expectations that it would be either maybe Yellen or Powell or Taylor or Cohen. Okay, so those names were in the hat and nothing's going on. Trial balloon one sent up. Nothing negative. Okay, what's happening next? Well, meetings happened. Meeting with Taylor, when that trial balloon was sent up, when that leak was seen and it was put out there, markets react a little bit differently. Bonds actually were problematic, sold off a bit. Okay, put that into another trial balloon and we know what happened there. A lunch with Yellen, that trial balloon was sent up and that was well received by markets. So that's good. Okay, so Yellen's a check mark there. So we know what's going on with that. Cohen is out. Another trial balloon was sent up a few days later. Cohen is not going to be probably on the final slate. Nothing really happened with the markets there. So nobody got concerned about that. And then Friday, there was midday, I guess it was, a trial balloon that it looks like the narrowing of the names has been pretty much leaning towards John Taylor. And Taylor, who is an economist, Powell. I'm sorry. Scratch that. Bring it back. Rewind it. Not Taylor, but Powell. Powell, because Taylor's a little bit more hawkish. Powell is pretty much seen as a replica. I've said this before. I talked about this on DH Unplugged with John, and I talked about this before on this show. Powell is basically seen as a replica, a replacement that's easy to do, which will allow for President Trump to provide his stamp of approval on the next Fed chair. And from what we can tell from everything that's been going on, one of the things that this administration wants to do is roll back some of the different things that were put into place or change things for the sake of changing to a degree, but also having their particular little, you know, their approval on the way of things are going financially. And if, in fact, there is someone who has a good amount of leanings towards things that Yellen and the Fed had at this point, who has a tremendous amount of experience under their belt, what we probably will see is that President Trump will decide with that party rather than keeping the old. So Yellen leaves, and then we have Powell in. Once that announcement and that trial balloon was put up on Friday, markets rallied even further. As a matter of fact, things were kind of just playing around and, you know, midday, and things were just kind of going along all right. And then there goes that news brief, that leak that President Trump could be leaning towards Powell at this point. And you know what? Markets rallied pretty dramatically. So what does that mean? Well, if Powell is going to be the next Fed chair, the big question is going to be who is going to be the vice chair. Now, it would seem to me to appease a lot of the players, because there was another trial balloon somewhere in the mix here, that there was a straw vote done in the Congress and said, who would you want to be? And Taylor overwhelmingly won that straw vote, whatever that was all about. So the probability here, from what I can see, is that we're going to have Taylor and Powell. Powell being the Fed chair and Taylor being the vice chair. So we're going to have an appeasement on some of the more hawkish and the individuals who don't like the massive amount of stimulus, low interest rates, free money, liquidity, and who really are on the side that we've been too loose for too long as the vice chair appeasement process, therefore giving them somebody in there that will hopefully hold the reins on the chair, who is considered to be very dovish, very Yellen-like, very easy money policy, very much fitting the bill of what the Fed is today. Having a bit of a checks and balances there. Now, I would say that the Fed chair is probably a much more prominent. It is a much more prominent, a much more influential, a much more important and persuasive position on the overall entire Fed decision-making process. But Taylor in there will be a very interesting way, like I said, of appeasing many of the lawmakers that have been very concerned with what the Fed has been doing for some time. So I think this is going to be a really interesting play. It should, I would say, within the next 2 weeks, if not sooner, especially with the reaction that we saw with the markets on Friday with regard to how they felt when that trial balloon was sent up. But trial balloons are everywhere. And this is just the way of checking with the markets, because, you know, the markets are all important these days. They're revered. you know, more important than the economics, more important than anything. It seems like the markets are an instantaneous reaction to the approval of what's going on with regard to any kind of move in Congress, which have been squarely focused on a few things, but clearly taxes and the health bill and a few other, you know, things about regulations. But it's what is going on right now. It is clearly is important for the market to give its sign of approval before Congress does anything. Good God forbid they do anything that changes the current market environment. They would be very upset by that. Regardless of where that would benefit other areas in the country and the world for that matter. Listen, so I want to talk about something. I have some listener questions I'll get to. But I did want to mention something to you because I mentioned this a few shows ago and I've been kind of hopping around and telling you about this, but I want to focus on a couple of things. You know, the whole idea of success in life. Well, you know, how do we break this down? I've been thinking about this. The whole, you know, success in life and success in business, success in investing, success just overall. I think I was thinking about how do you break this down and make it the most simplistic equation possible? How do you get there? And you know what I was thinking? It's basically the equation is simply opportunity plus decisions made reveals what level of success you'll have. In other words, you're presented with opportunities on so many things in life. If you just break everything down, what is it? Somebody asks you a question, somebody asks you to do something you're thinking about doing, it's an opportunity. Think of it as an opportunity. And then you have to then decide what to do. Now, there's a couple of different routes you could take, right? You could answer a question, yes or no. You could say, I'm going to do this choice or that choice, or possibly maybe a third or fourth one if you come up and think of something that may be an alternative. But basically, if you think about opportunities as the first door, and then your reaction to that, your decision to that as the potential key to that door, what you get from that is the potential road for and the roadmap to success. So let's just break this down very easily and tell you where I'm going with this, because there is a place I'm going with this. Let's say very simply you have two doors. One door is bright red. It says, enter through this door and you'll be very successful in life. And the other one is bright green. It says, you know, enter this door and it's going to be disaster in life. So now you have in front of you the opportunity and you have the key, which is your decision. What do you choose? Left door, right door, red door, green door. Well, obviously you can say, oh, I choose the one that's better. Take that key, that decision, turn it. You know, so the idea of investing and the idea of making a decision on what to do and getting yourself off the fence and making that decision is I think part of the process and pretty much the opportunity and the decision, the key to open up the next level of success. So what we did is where I'm coming to the whole part of this. You know, if you want to be successful, you have to do something. You can't just say, I'm not making a decision. Now, sometimes, yes, not making a decision is a decision, but you have to make a decision to do something. So we gave you this opportunity. We created this investology, this advisor-crafted, technology-enhanced entire program for you to use. And we had some really good pickup. We had the beta test, and then we had the opening and the soft opening and the official launch and the party. You probably have had, hopefully, the opportunity to check that out over on investology.com. You go over there. And it says just there's a little couple of buttons there. You could design your own portfolios. But I wanted to make sure you take advantage of this because this is, I think, a really great opportunity. There's the door, right? The opportunity. You make the decision. Do I want to do this or not? This is a great opportunity for you to take that key and open up the right door here. This is where you can actually have part of your portfolio on a process where we're managing this for you on a diversified approach that does rebalancing and gives you a full degree of correlation to your risk, your time horizon, all that. This is an opportunity for you. And to make it even easier, what I want to do is we have these really cool challenge coins that we had created. They're these investology challenge questions. You have to see them. I'll put a picture of what they look like on the show notes for this. The next 25 people that take this opportunity and use their key in the decision-making process to open up the right door here, if you understand where I'm going with this, fund your account, set it up, will get a challenge coin from us. Now, is it, you know, what does that mean? Is it worth anything? Okay. It's really kind of a cool thing. I'm trying to get you to make the right, I'm trying to coax you to make that right decision to help you on the road towards success for your future. That's what I'm trying to do here. I'm not going to beat this into your head too much because, you know, if you don't want to take this opportunity, I can't twist your arm here. But it is a really cool platform. And you have to see it to understand it. It's a really cool platform. You can see everything that's going on in your portfolio. You can understand what's happening with the allocation of your assets. You can change your particular risk models pretty much at any time, which we don't want you doing every day because that doesn't make any sense. But you can go in there and you can design your entire portfolio. And then what we do is through a process, an algorithm that we develop, we can figure out what is the most appropriate portfolio for you over time. This is not a trading portfolio. But what this is there's so many great features of it is in terms of no transaction fee, investments that are inside of the portfolio, as well as a rebalancing process, as well as full transparency, low cost. There's a lot of cool things that are going on there. Anyway, I'm going to leave it at that and come back to it at another time. But just again, success is a basic formula of opportunities and the decisions made on those opportunities. Here is an opportunity for you. You have the key. You have the opportunity to make that decision. Okay. And you'll get that challenge coin with that. I'm thinking about maybe also sending a copy. Now the book, if you haven't seen, actually, you know what this is what I'll do. We'll send you a challenge coin and I'll send you a copy, a signed copy of the Disciplined Investor book, the soft cover book that was my first book that we put out. I'll send you a copy of that. You get to see a picture of me with my and the mustache that I had at that point, which everybody makes fun of, but I'll send that to you as well. All right, earnings. Let's see what else. I want to mention a couple things on earnings. First of all, Jeff Bezos now the richest person in the world after the Friday rally of Amazon, which moved up dramatically after their earnings beat. Microsoft could have been probably one of the better names that I saw on earnings. And in particular, revenue, they had a $1 billion revenue beat. $1 billion. Think about that. The analyst estimates were, or in other words, $1 billion under what actually was reported. And it's very hard to fudge that number. It's not like some kind of weird EPS number that they kind of did a one-time footnoted exclusion of this or that or shoved something in this quarter versus that last quarter. They had $1 billion revenue beat. That was very impressive. Seems that the company is hitting on all cylinders. They backed off a bit from the top where they were rallying on Friday, but still an all-time high. And a lot of this was from the process of transferring much of their software in particular to the cloud and their subscription base, as well as a few other things they have, their Azure and some hardware as well, of course. But you know, it reminds me of Adobe. And as far back as I can think, I think one of the greatest changes in structure on how software was distributed was not too long ago when Adobe went from a software package that was either fully downloaded, one-time payment, an annual renewable for licensure to and CDs and DVDs for their entire package of various Adobe products and platforms to a subscription model, which everybody said, uh-oh, how is that going to work? And Adobe took it on the chin for a while because their revenues really fell short because they went from a all upfront type of model where you pay me, let's just pick a number, $500 for the program and they would renew it. And the problem was that maybe a lot of people weren't renewing it, to a model now where they would say, okay, well, it's $39.95 a month or $59.95 a month, depending on what you decided to, you know, what packages you decided to take. And in the beginning, there was a lot of concern about this. There was, you know, a lot of wonderment. Whoa, is this going to work? Are people going to keep the subscription? But what happened here is with the old process, people can keep an old copy forever and use that forever. If they wanted to get updates, they'd have to pay for it. But they said, you know what? I'm not updating. I'll just use it. It works fine. Now you get fully updated software all the time through your subscription, and Adobe continues to get ongoing revenue. If you stop at any time, everything is gone. In other words, you can't keep an old program any longer just running in the background because you have to authenticate your subscription. There's a few ways to get around that, but what I'm saying is that's what people have been doing. And Adobe, the stock went from, listen, it works. Earnings have been great. Revenues have been great, increasing on a regular basis. Stock went from 70 to about 170 since 2016. Not bad, right? So it goes to show how the cost savings and the overall benefits of using centrally located software for users really pays off. Plus, what do you get? You have a company that now has lower costs for distribution. They don't have to ship software out anymore. They don't have to have replacement DVDs sent out. They don't have to package it and sell it in stores, right? They have less staff requirements because you don't have to have any of those people taking calls for the ordering necessarily. I mean, there's still obviously customer service, but you don't need anybody taking those orders. You don't need an entire factory producing all of this software, DVDs, packaging it, sending it out, transportation, trucking, logistics. Think about this for a second. Think about this. It's kind of like, can you imagine if there was such a thing as buying a TV, but nobody produces it? Somehow it magically appears in your house, somehow, magically. And there's no store that sells it necessarily. There's nobody that produces it. No parts to be sent or bought or shipped. Nothing to be trucked. Nothing to be, no returns. You follow what I'm saying? I mean, it's kind of the same concept. A little bit off, but yes, it's still the same thing where they really cut out a tremendous amount of cost if it works. And if they can actually convince the public to do such a thing, which would require obviously a fast internet connection for updates, downloads, and for authentication, and a buy-in that's a reasonable enough price that can make up for the totality of the costs overall, and even saving a little bit for the consumer possibly, which may or may not happen, because of all the things and the intermediate things that don't have to happen anymore in that brilliant process. I think a lot of people, including myself, were a little skeptical in the beginning of this and were wondering how this was actually going to work, but it worked out just fine. And obviously, there's a lot of companies now copying Adobe's success with this, as we've seen what's going on with many of the major producers of any kind of software. And finally, Sanjay Nadella got on the wagon over at Microsoft and made a major change after he took over the reins, and you can see how well that's doing overall for the company. Pretty amazing. Now, I did mention also that in the beginning, that at the top there, that confidence, consumer confidence at an all-time high. There was some really interesting research that I dug into this weekend, and I took a look at this. This is kind of cool. So we did see that consumer confidence based on the University of Michigan numbers were at the highest level they've been in years. Pretty cool. The revised numbers come out three times. This one was a little bit lower, but still very, very high overall number from consumer confidence. And even with the hurricanes, even with the natural disasters we saw, even with some of the things that have gone on around the world, confidence is up. That could be because the markets are up and more people are working and better wages and all. A lot of things go into this. But the good news is confidence is up. Now, that's consumer confidence. What about investor confidence? What about bullish sentiment? Well, here's something that I found from Yardini Research, who tracks this. You can look this up. He has, a piece he puts out every single week, which you can just grab off the web. It's a nice PDF with a lot of charts and a lot of information that's on there. According to the latest research of Yardini, bulls are at the highest level they've been in years. Right now, the Bulls are at 62.3% versus Bears only at 15.1%. In other words, there aren't a lot of Bears out there. There are a lot of Bulls, not a lot of Bears. Only 22% of the survey believe that there'll be a correction coming, as opposed to 24% just a few weeks ago. So only 22% of the surveyed people that have been asked whether or not there is a correction, a market correction, that will be coming in the relatively near future, only 22% said yes. That's interesting. Now, there's another thing that's really kind of fascinating is that the ratio of Bulls to Bears is now at 4.13%, at the highest we've seen from about 2014 to 2015, right about in there. There was the same ratio. The ratio is basically a division, right? It looks at how many Bulls, we saw 62.3 versus Bears 15.1. So it's a four-time multiple, four times more Bulls than there are Bears right now. Not that much balance. Now, what does this all mean? Well, Bears will tell you, well, people are overconfident. And this is a major contrary indicator. The Bulls will tell you, all's good, green light. We don't want to see these kind of numbers. Things continue for some time. Buy, buy, buy. But there's other factors. There's actually several other factors that are showing us also a slightly to a little bit more advanced overheating of market conditions. Because we have a product of what we know to be massive liquidity and good economic data. And good earnings, low U.S. dollar, relaxed regulatory environment. That should be interesting. But probably some of this confidence that we're seeing and some of the actual numbers that are showing an overheated market at this point should be somewhat of a warning sign. Now, I talked about this last week. And one of the things I said last week is, wouldn't it be funny if we know that the final quarter of the year, October, November, December, known for its seasonally bullish trends, now, there's an important word there, that word known for. Or let me say it differently. The expectation is that we have seen a very good seasonally bullish environment in the final quarter of the year, known as the Santa Claus rally, known as the fourth quarter move. Everybody wants to get in. Wouldn't it be interesting if, because everybody knows the algorithms and those that are in the camp that can move things, say, hey, everybody knows this. Everybody's expecting this. Let's do the opposite. Now, that doesn't necessarily happen with a snap of a finger and a decision just like that. But we did see some interesting seasonality differentials in September and October. Talked about that last sign. Now, the clear sign is that the trend is bullish. Bulls are not concerned. We know that. They have said that. As a matter of fact, they're getting kind of cocky. That's something I find interesting. Watching my Twitter feed lately, I've noticed that the Bulls have become ridiculously cocky and snarky. And if somebody doesn't agree with what they talk about, they're stupid and they're to be totally publicly humiliated that they don't agree with the fact that this particular thing is going to happen for a period of time. Not just one day, but just a period of time. And when that person says, I think markets have topped or whatever, that bull will come back at them a week or two later and say, see that? You're stupid. You didn't know what you're talking about. What's wrong with you? Look at this trend. Can't you agree with everybody else? Now, okay. They were wrong. I'll give you that. And the bulls have been right. The bulls have been right for a long time. That's not okay. The bears have been wrong for a long time. Okay. Everything cycles. Never forget that. Everything cycles. Does that mean we're going to have a crash and a correction of 50% of the markets in a period of time that's going to just be shocking? And from now till the end of the... No, I'm not suggesting that. I'm just telling you, keep an open mind. Everything cycles. Everything cycles. And the bulls right now are seeing that there's no concern. Every dip is a buying opportunity. We know that to be true. They see an all clear for most parts of the market. And that's been somewhat true. But individual names have been another story altogether. But generally, there's been this this desire to put money to work in this low yielding environment. We all know that. But there's also something to be said about it's not just here in the U.S. And this idea that this is a Trump rally, which a lot of people have been talking about, or a tax rally here in the United States that is predicated, it's questionable. Why do I say that? Now, I'm not saying that this one or that one shouldn't get credit, but let's kind of think about something for a second. If it was just a rally based on our presidential situation, do you think that the entire world will be rallying as well? Or is it more appropriate to say that there is something going on in terms of earnings and economics that could be a leftover or part and parcel of that in combination with some global trends that are going on that are helping? If we're seeing things like, as an example, in Europe, the Europe Swedish cap ETF up 23%, Germany up 23%, Spain up 22%, France up 26%, Netherlands up 29%, Portugal up 31%, Greece up 16%, Norway up 21%. Do you think all of those are rallying because of the tax situation here? That we may have corporate tax relief and we may have repatriation and we may have individual tax cuts? Does that seem right? Seems kind of bogus to me. Doesn't make any sense at all, in fact, if you think about that. Why would Japan be rallying on a tax cut here? I'm sure somebody can make up some kind of reason and excuse why that's happening. Why would Europe be rallying on a environment of deregulations in the U.S. banking area? Why would it be rallying on a particular president being elected or not? Some of this is a little thin. You know, some of this, I can't put credit on all this. What it looks to me more like is a combination of all the above. There's not one reason, but we do see that, as I mentioned 100 times, if not once, that liquidity is great around the world. Even Mario Draghi last week when he was talking, he managed to jawbone the euro lower, talking about while he will be possibly reducing some of the quantitative easing programs down to about only $30 billion per month, that they're probably going to extend the period. So no change. The euro dropped, helping out their markets. So the liquidity is there. The economics have been really in good shape. Whether or not that's reason and believed to be because of the Fed and the central banks around the world, or the reduced regulation, or the particular politicians that have been recently elected, whether it's from Japan or the United States or anywhere else in Germany with some re-election issues. I mean, it's a combination of all this. It's all working together. And that's a good thing. Nothing bad about that. But let's not try to pin it on this or that, because that's where we get in trouble. But have an open mind and realize that, yes, this can continue on for some time if all these things stay in place. In particular, if the Fed maintains a very low interest rate environment, we have a very dovish Fed chair, and we have a continuation of much of the global stimulus that we're seeing from Japan in particular and from Europe. Moving along to some stocks that I thought were interesting to talk about. First of all, Twitter, big mover on the week. Finally has some good things to say about Twitter. Good chunk of the user growth was from outside the U.S. They had a better expected monthly average user, which I'm not quite sure if that's something that's really important to reckon with these days. But anyway, they did an adjustment and took out about 1 to 2 million users per month over the last, I think it was 12 months. They removed that, and now they came up with a 4 million more active users or those so than last, and some other numbers. But what was really cool was there's a lot of people on the short side of Twitter, and you have the opportunity over a number of days to see a short squeeze happen. Now, I want to see if some of the earnings and outlook and some of the optimism of recently what was stated is going to be able to be held. We'll have to watch that for probably over the next week. We had about a 25% move up from the lows last week on the stock after their earnings came out. And the big question, again, is whether that is just a massive short squeeze with all the names that we're expecting Twitter to just, you know, die a long and lonely death, okay, on the short side, and whether they're just covering that right now into the close. All right, a couple more things to talk about here before we get to some questions here. Let's just go through my list here. We talked about the economics and trial balloons. Talked about the challenge coin. You have to actually open up an account on Investology, go through the process, very easy and interesting process. Investology, and just click on one of the things that says start now. Yeah, design your portfolio, open an account, fund the account. We'll send you a challenge coin, and we'll send you a signed book, The Disciplined Investor. I'll sign it. Not just anybody's signature. I'll sign it. And we talked about earnings. Okay, I think we're pretty caught up on that. Let's see what else I got here. GE. Had a discussion with Frank Curzio last week about the stock. Got a lot of emails about that, going back and forth, whether or not this is a good idea. GE seems that, that stock got hit. Question is whether it's going to be able to hold. It seems that after it got hit, after its earnings, it made a slight turnaround to the upside. After everybody thought, oh, a kitchen sink quarter was cold. We got the new CEO in and, you know, they're really just throwing everything bad out there. How much worse can it get? Maybe a slight cut to the dividend coming in their November next meeting. And have we seen the flush low here? We've seen some major volume on the flush. The potential for a capitulation is there. There's some support by, I would say, about the 1975 area, about from 2012. I'll tell you, I bought some from my portfolio, my personal portfolio. I put it in my IRA, which is code for I'm leaving it there for a while. It's got a 4.5% dividend, which may be slightly cut, but this is not a swing trade. This is kind of a long-term, unless something really weird happens. This will be a trade that I hold on to for some time, believing that GE can actually do something and that the current disdain for the stock is not going to be forever and it's not going bankrupt. Apple, some very interesting news on the stock. This seems that the iPhone 8 we know is having lackluster sales, but however, we've seen that the iPhone X is having historic, if not major numbers on the ordering for the iPhone X. Probably the weakness of iPhone 8 could be, what happened to iPhone 9? Where did that go, by the way? I'm confused about that. Anyway, the iPhone 8, we know that didn't have great sales. I wonder if some of the fact that the sales were soft is because they postponed the offering on and the opportunity to get the iPhone X for a bit after the iPhone 8 release. And everybody's like, well, let's see what they come up with that. And maybe I'll make my decision after that. Let's see what else here. All right. Let me just make sure I have everything here. All right. I want to follow up on my recent discussion about, just very, very quickly, on the TD Ameritrade ETF and fund changes and all the things that they did on the no transaction fee front. The good news and bad news, we don't have a lot of changes here. This is kind of like a write your congressman moment. We did see that they did extend the date until mid-January till any changes have to be made. The good news is there's plenty of good fund and investment choices on the NTF platform and some of those that we use inside of Investology. But I still am very curious about where this is all going. You know, are brokerages going to only come up with their own funds and ETFs and things that they want to really promote for the almighty bottom dollar? Or is there going to be some of the fiduciary rules that sneak in here and the DOL rules that are going to be requiring these companies to give the best for individuals? I mean, they do not have to, and nobody has a gun to their head saying, well, they have to do it for free. We know that. So there's other creative ways which they make money from the money they have in the accounts, whether it's through commissions or whether it's through transaction fees or whether it's through 12b1 fees, kickbacks from the various funds. We know that. But I'll keep you updated on what's going on there. We also put some new stories on Investology recently on some of our discussions with fund managers. We have one from Bill Gross and his team, as well as some really interesting insight on economics from another group that we just put up there this week. So you can check those out. We write there under the scoop. Check out the scoop. All right, that list is... All right, what do we got now? We got questions. We have questions. Oh, no. Before we do that, let's get to what's coming up in and what has gone on with the recent economics. I have this all outlined. Probably usually do this at the beginning of the show, but I got off on a talking tangent, didn't I? I get going sometimes. Oh, we have, let's see. All right. We saw the third quarter GDP come out. We saw the estimate and the number on first revision came in at 3%. That was good. Growth averaged 2.2% per quarter since the end of the recession in 2009. So now we're seeing a 3% number come out. We'll see how that holds up after the next month. New home buying increased by 18.9% in September. They're calling it unexpected. I'm saying, well, that makes sense. We saw a drop down, and that was post, you know, during the whole hurricane and fires and all that. So it doesn't seem to be that surprising to me, at least. The Census Bureau said that the sales pace reached a 10-year peak. So we see the surge put the year-over-year gains for new homes at 17%. We mentioned earlier that University of Michigan, that was good. We mentioned also that the NASDAQ was up 2.2% Friday, gained 1% for the week. The S&P gained 0.23% for the week. Dow is up 0.45% for the week. What do we have coming next week? Well, Monday we have personal spending numbers from that we're going to be looking at, and some baseline inflation numbers, along with earnings from a variety of companies, Rent-A-Center. Now we have on Tuesday, and Lowe's, Mondelez. On Tuesday we have Conference Board's latest Consumer Confidence Index. This usually see towards the end of the month, which is right on target. The end of the month is on Tuesday. We're going to see earnings from a variety of companies, Kellogg, MasterCard, Pfizer, Under Armour. On Wednesday, Federal Reserve policy statement, ADP payrolls. Yep, it's again payrolls time. Friday is going to be the next level. See if we have a recovery post hurricane. Thursday we're going to see. Let's see here. We have Shake Shack. Sorry, on Wednesday Shake Shack, Estee Lauder, Facebook, Garmin, GoPro, Hanes. What else is in this list here? Tesla. Then we have on Thursday Alibaba, Apple, AutoNation, Live Nation, Genworth, Starbucks, Wayfair, and Yum Brands. And we're going to see the Labor's October, the October labor report on payrolls on Friday, as well as October ISM services and PMI earnings from Bloomin' Brands, Duke Energy, and Shell Midstream Partners. All this coming up. Let's get to some listener questions before we move on. And I'll mention that you can ask me any questions you want, depending on what they are, what the complexity is, whether they're appropriate for, we'll answer them on the show. But a lot of questions I also answer personally. So you go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and you can simply click on the Ask Andrew button there somewhere. There's a bunch of them all over the place, and ask a question. We had a couple of interesting ones that came in, and I just want to hit those really quickly. The first one's from Stephen H. He says, I listened to your recent podcast on hurricane impacts on the economy. I respectfully disagree that Reconstruction and hurricane will have stimulative effects. Reconstruction has to be done, but not necessarily boost GDP because all the lost productivity during the recovery time. A not so appropriate analogy would be, let's have a war, then reconstruct the whole world. Can you elaborate? Well, Steve, I know you don't want to hear this and nobody wants to hear this, but you know what? Let's have a war and reconstruct the whole world. During the World War, there's all sorts of people that are working on things like artillery and machines, and people are getting paid and things are happening, and it's awful. Don't get me wrong. We don't want a war. Let's just get that straight first. If people are going to think, oh my God, Horowitz wants a war. No. But have you ever seen the boomtown and boom times after and during a war. Some of the best economic numbers you can see. And then afterwards, the reconstruction process, yeah, that benefits a lot of people. The United States has done an incredible job at this, haven't they? Gone into various places around the world, tore them down just to help them rebuild. Why is that? It's financial. If you don't believe me, there's plenty of books on this. In terms of the hurricane, yes, loss of productivity. And again, please, nobody freak out that I'm advocating that we have natural disasters or we have some kind of horrible acts or we have war. I'm just telling you the numbers here. But one of the things you see after natural disasters, assuming the fact that the natural disaster is in an area that actually has a major amount of work. Let's look at Texas. How many of those houses will be taken down and how much more work will be required to build it? And if you say, well, you know, there's a lot of loss of productivity during the period. So what do you have? You have a 2-month period when there's a loss of productivity, but a 1-year period of new productivity. Just look at it that way. How long was the storm? How long was the problem? Yeah. And then from there, think about it. Yeah. Yeah. So, well, you have a year, you have months, you have all sorts of time and a lot more people working. One person's house comes down, insurance company pays, 25 people may get to work on that particular house. Think about that. All right, and we have another question from, again, just back up here. I'm not advocating, and I don't like any of the things that happen, but I'm just saying, what does in fact go on? It's not in every circumstance. If it's a small little storm and people are put out and there's no reconstruction and there's not a move to get things back, no, it's not going to do anything from the economy. But think about the local economies, how they can benefit. They'll be hurt for a while, but if they are going to get paid, particularly from insurance companies, and rebuild, there is the opportunity to really see a significant, very short-lived uptick that could eclipse all the problems. It's a money transfer from insurance companies to the economy. This next question is from Kalafa. He says, in the 2008 financial bubble, now if the 2008 financial bubble was able to be identified before it occurred, how would you see the default rates? Would it be going up or would it rise? And also, would the value of CDOs lose its status? The thing that happened in 2008 was that we saw that loans were souring. We saw that people were borrowing beyond their means. We saw that the people were losing jobs left and right. We saw that in the back end, even though CDO prices weren't moving as necessarily because they were artificially being held up by the players, by the governments, by the players. They did not want to actually, they didn't want to admit to the facts. So what we had to see was behind it, and just watch The Big Short. This will tell you really what happened there. You would have seen it from a lot of the economic numbers. It was pretty darn clear to me back in about 2006 that we had a big problem, that the loans that were being given out were done with no major checks. There was no background check in terms of financials or creditworthiness or anything else. Very loose environment, not the same today. I'm not sure if you're trying to put what happened then to today, much different circumstance of what happened. Could it happen again? Probably not the same way, but yes, we could see another major catastrophe along another lines. Give banks enough time, they'll cause a major crisis. Trust me. Just give them enough time. Give them enough rope. There'll be something else they'll think of, and they'll just crash the economy. And then the Fed will step in and recapitalize them, and the government will step in and give them all sorts of money, and then we'll just move on again. But the way that you would see it back then was all through the changing and very quickly changing dynamics of currencies, of economics, of jobs, of what was happening in the credit markets overall, what was happening to companies' earnings. And then it happened very fast. But you know what? From about 2006, we'll call it, things were getting really crazy for no reason. Speculative natures of people were going through the roof. The margin levels they had, much greater than margin on their brokerage accounts because they were doing it with houses, went crazy. They were taking money out on margin, essentially, and not being able to pay it back and spending it on all sorts of things because the banks were allowing them to do so while using their houses as ATMs. That's where the problems came in, on top of all the other problems. So I don't know if CDOs will lose its status if, in fact, we go through some of that before. I mean, they've lost their status already to a degree. And, you know, credit default swaps and CDOs and I don't know. I mean, I think you would see a little bit of a letdown there and all the packaging that goes on, clearly. But then they'll come back again because, like I said, give them enough time. The banks will create another crisis and go on from there. Anyway, we're going to end it there. Thank you so much for joining me. Andrew Horowitz here. And take use of that opportunity for success for your future. Use the key that I gave you. Pick the right door. Go over to Investology. And then you get a free challenge coin as well and a signed book. I don't know how else I can push you to do this. I really encourage you to do this. You're going to really, all the people that have done it so far have written me and said, this is great. I love this. It's a really cool way to do things. Investology. We'll put a link on the show notes from this particular episode, number 532. Got it on the website over on the Disciplined Investor as well. Any questions, send them to Ask Andrew. Listen to DH Unplugged each and every week. I'll see you next week. Happy Halloween. Bye-bye.
The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contains forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.